This is Courage to Resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refuse to fight. Kimberly Rivera is a wife and the mother of two small children. She is also a GI resister. After serving three troubling months in Iraq, Kimberly came home on leave and made the life-changing decision not to return to the war. She and her family drove to Canada, where she is seeking refugee status. She is speaking to us on the phone today from her home in Toronto. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you have quite a story to tell, including the fact that you served two separate stints in the U.S. Army. Why don't you begin by telling us how you got yourself into the Army two different times?
It's kind of funny, actually. Well, for me, anyway. Well, as most people know, the recruiters start out on you at a very early age in high school, and sometimes they will approach you even at 16, because it's really hard to tell the ages of the kids in high school. And it's like, once they find out you're not 16 or you're not a junior or senior, they have nothing to do with you. They won't speak to you the rest of the year. But the next year comes when they get your rosters from school, they start calling your home, they start setting up their tables again in the lunchroom, and continuing to just do their spill on you over and over and over. And as a high school student, you're not really prepared, I guess, to make a life-changing decision, and that's what the military is. But I made that decision. And sometimes I feel maybe I was a little forced to do it, being that I lived at home with my mom and dad still, because I'm in high school, and I never wanted to be a burden on them. So I thought, you know, this would be the best way that I can take care of my money for school. But also, I just basically had to sit down with the recruiters at my home after they had called me like several times, and I finally talked to them, realizing that they're not going to stop calling until I talk with them. One recruiter came to my parents' house, sat down with me and my parents, and basically gave all the positive of reasons on why I should join the military. And then they're like, well, if you want, you can just go and take the test and see what jobs you qualify for. And I'm like, okay. So I agreed to go do that. What I realized is when they first gave their spill, they had my parents sign some type of, they called it a permission slip or something, to just allow them to talk with us. But I'd come to find out that wasn't necessarily a permission slip to allow them to talk to us. It was a permission slip to allow them to recruit me. But I'm not thinking that the government is playing people like that, because I grew up being told and know that America is the greatest place on earth, and I had patriotism. It's like, it's just ingrained in you. So in 2000, I was a junior and I went and took the test, and then I next had to talk to a military counselor. And when I go to talk to the counselor, he's the one that's actually going to be telling me what kind of jobs I qualify with my scores. The military has over 270, maybe even 300 different types of jobs you can get into now. And they gave me three choices. That's what was really odd. So I chose a job, but not knowing that when I chose that job, I signed for a military contract. And then after signing it, I just had to basically convince myself that I was, that I did the right thing and that this is going to be the right choice for me.
You thought that you were agreeing that if you went into the military, this is the job you'd like, but in fact you were enlisting at that time without realizing it?
It goes through so fast, and after you pick your job, you sit in the little place and you basically are waiting to be sworn in. And then from that moment on, I'm like, you know what, I just joined the military.
So how did you feel when you realized that that was the case?
In a way, I felt a little betrayed, but then I'm like, you know, I was told already all the benefits and everything that it could be to help me, and I'm just like, well, I guess I'm doing this.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 17.
So, you went off to basic training?
Yeah, I went to basic. Nothing was really real to me. Like, I grew up in Texas. I was always around guns, and I was very much a tomboy, so doing that type of stuff and playing and doing the little obstacle courses and do the whole kill stuff was just a game to me, basically. It wasn't real. I'm like, hey, what's the best thing I can do? Shoot guns, hit guys, and roll with it.
The fact is, lots of people have trouble with basic training, but you had none?
Well, I don't know. I never wanted to tell the drill sergeant that I thought basic wasn't as hard as a volleyball conditioning camp was. Just because I was scared that they would make it harder, and then everybody will be like, yeah, it's my fault. Yeah, that would have been the worst thing in basic.
But you did have some medical issues in basic.
Starting feeling really sick in the morning, just in the mornings, and by afternoon I felt fine, and so I went to sick call like 3 times. And then by then I think they thought I was just a hypochondriac. And I'm like, I can't explain why I'm feeling nauseous every morning. And then I come and they say I'm completely healthy and there's nothing wrong with me. And I'm like, no, something is wrong. You gotta know something's wrong. And I was talking to my mom still at that time, so she just, did you go get a pregnancy test? And then, like, the 4th time, I actually requested on my sick call slip for a pregnancy test, which they didn't do, by the way. They did a pap smear and, like, sat me in a room for, like, the whole day. And then, at the end of the day, they gave me this little bottle of pills, and they said, hey, this will take care of all your problems. It was really scary. They just said, oh, this will take care of all your problems. And I get back to my bay, and I'm totally freaking out, because I'm like, I know that the military doesn't want women to have babies, but didn't take it. And it was for an infection. And I'm like, you know, still, I never did take them. And so I just kept going through all the motions. I passed basic training in October. So then I went to AIT. My mom slipped me a pregnancy test. Because anything that you buy from the PX and basic, if it wasn't on the list that they allowed you to go into, it was considered contraband, and you can get in trouble for having it. And what they did is they stood by the door and made sure that you're only getting requested items. And then anybody who had, like, a candy bar or some aspirin or even multivitamins on their thing was subject to Article 15, which is just whatever they wanted to do to you to get you back in line, basically.
If you had purchased a pregnancy test, you would have gotten in trouble, is that right?
Yeah, I was about a month into AIT when I actually got the nerve up to actually take it, because I already knew, but I wasn't for sure because I hadn't taken a test, and sure enough, it showed I was positive. And now that I'm just this part-time soldier, now I have a family, and I need more benefits than just the college money, the GI Bill, when I ask them, you know, hey, what can you guys do for me? And there wasn't really much, because by the time I got home, it was highly unlikely that I was going to have a baby on the weekend. I have only 4 weekends of every month, only considered active duty when I'm doing my weekend duty, basically, as a reservist. And I took the test, and I told my drill sergeants, and I went through the mill of why I would like to go back home, and it was already close to Christmas and the Thanksgiving holidays, which I missed waiting to be sent home. And they agreed that we both agreed that probably that would be the best thing for us. And I realize now it's totally easier to get out of any type of training than it is for you to actually get out of your permanent duty station.
So you were out of the Army, basically, then?
I had an honorable discharge. I could get back in the service anytime I wanted. And it took probably like 5 more years, and I just got to that point in my life that my job no longer is secure. I had no benefits because they worked me full-time, but only as a part-time associate. So I couldn't get any of the benefits that they were giving, because that's how they chose to run their business.
You were working at Walmart, yes?
I was working at Walmart. It's like walking on eggshells. You're afraid, because you're making $10.50 an hour, that you're going to be the next person that they're going to fire, because it's easier to pull in somebody else at $7.50 an hour doing your same job, and all you had to do was train them.
So you were feeling financially insecure, you had no benefits, and so you made another crucial decision.
Yep.
What did you do this time?
I'm like, you know, I kind of know a little bit about the military, the Army, so why not go back in? I had this honorable discharge I can use to get back in.
So you joined up again?
Yeah, I signed up again. Everything that a person needs to live successfully with a family, they have.
In the military, you're saying?
In the military.
And you signed up this time in the regular army?
Yeah, regular, because I want to make sure I had all those benefits that I needed.
And you became a full-time soldier?
Full-time soldier.
Did you have the same job when you went in the second time?
No, because I never qualified for my AIT because it was a six-month training, so I never got certified in it. I could re-enlist to be in any type of job that I wanted.
What did you choose this time?
What could be better than drive it? At least I don't have to work on them.
Ah, you became a truck driver.
Yes, I, not knowing that's probably one of the fastest killed-off soldiers that there is in the military, and which, no wonder I got like an $8,000 sign-on bonus. And my training was only a month long, which was another reason why I decided to just get that one, because then I wouldn't be so far away from my children for so long.
So you trained as a truck driver for a month?
Yeah, they basically just test you for the truck driving, give you the truck driving exam. And they go through all the trainings and you learn how to back up big trailers and a whole bunch of other things, and all within a month.
And did you deploy to Iraq immediately after that?
Well, after that I got to my regular unit. And the first sergeant, when I first got there, he's like, hey, we're getting ready. We're just doing training to go to Iraq or whatever. But if we haven't got orders that say that we're going, I'm like, okay, that's good. And then I wasn't really worried, but I'm like, we're training for it. I assume that's just what the Army's going to do anyway. And I wasn't necessarily concerned that that's where I'd be going, but if we were going to go, I was looking forward to serving some type of military action, because then I felt like I was doing my part in the world, you know, and protecting my family and keeping things safe. And I was very anxious to get that combat patch.
How soon was it that you were actually deployed?
One day on CNN, I see 30,000 troops will be deployed in October, and I knew I was going to be one of them. And then the next day, the first sergeant comes and tells us, oh, by the way, we got orders deploying us to Iraq.
You heard your orders first from television news.
Yeah. And I'm like, somebody knew before the news knew that we were going out. And the fact that they didn't have the courage to tell people just because they were afraid that somebody didn't want to fight was ridiculous. I'm like, if somebody doesn't want to fight, don't let them fight. That's the easiest thing. Because it's worse if you have somebody go over there and kill themselves in a porta pot because they don't believe in what's going on, but they have no way out. That did happen.
And did you feel that way yourself? Did you not believe in fighting in Iraq?
Well, at that particular moment, I wasn't really. I'm like, okay, let's go do this and get home and spend time with my family. And I just felt like the easiest way I could do that was just go and do what I need to do and get home as fast as I could.
Now, as I understand it from you, when you got to Iraq, it was not easy for you.
No, it wasn't easy, of course. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. There was times that I went about a month, maybe a month and a half without sleeping, and maybe with a couple of hours worth of sleep, and then get up and do my 18-hour shift and stay up cleaning my weapon, washing my clothes, just doing the simple task of daily life, and then having to wake back up and go right back to guard duty. And it was just really stressful.
Were there things that you experienced there that were disturbing to you personally as well?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I felt like, and I've always felt like the soldiers were good guys. They were the good guys, you know? They're the ones that help people when they're in need. They're the ones that rebuild the things that rebuild places. And that's kind of how I felt with Iraq. I mean, I always thought the purpose there was to gain the heart of the people, and that wasn't the case. There's actually a couple main incidents that happened that made me really question everything from myself all the way to my service, all the way to why I'm here. And everything. And one of those is I worked at the front gate, and every single Saturday, different civilians, just civilians that don't work with us, come in and put in a claim for restitution, basically. And I didn't know what their family had gone through. I didn't know what they had lost. Some of them gotten their only rifle in the house taken from them, which may be their only security for their family, for anybody coming in. And some of them gotten their young teenage boys and their husbands taken from them and wondering where they are. And some of them had been traumatically injured. On this one Saturday, I remember, just clear as day, just like I see everybody now that I approach on a daily basis, like I have never left Iraq, I see this little girl. She was about 2 years old, maybe, yeah, she was about 2 years old. Same age as my little girl back home, and I could just see her shaking. It was like a violent shake, not a seizure type shake, but noticeable. And tears were just rolling out of her face, rolling down her eyes. She wasn't weeping, she wasn't crying, nothing. And kids don't just cry without screaming, you know? And I knew that those were traumatic, traumatized. Something traumatizing happened to that little girl that she would have tears of trauma roll down her face. And I was helpless. There was nothing I could do. I was in all my battle gear. I was carrying an M16 assault rifle, and it was loaded because I was required to keep it on red safe when I was on the job. And I was just scared that if I was to just pick her up like I wanted to do and just kind of ensure her that everything was going to be okay, even though I didn't know if everything could be okay or what happened to her. I couldn't comprehend how this dad would have to deal with that. And I couldn't comprehend, being a mom myself, how I would react to my little girl being that way and knowing that I'm helpless to do anything to help her or even know what's going on in her mind or been through the situation that she's been through. And that was very traumatizing for me because I personally could imagine I was seeing my little girl the same way that she was. It really affected me. And the older women are so mature and so proud and just of being alive. And they don't speak a lick of English. And they would just come and sit and stare at you while they're waiting to do their claims. And in their eyes, piercing your heart and your soul, basically saying, why are you doing this to me? What did I do to you that would cause you to want to hurt my family like this? And you could feel it. They didn't have to say it. You could feel it, and you could see it in their face. And I couldn't take that. I can see just people, Iraqi civilians that worked with us, lose somebody that they just knew and would rip their clothes and fall down on the ground. I had no idea what the heck was going on. That seemed totally not like any type of grief that I've ever seen in my entire life. But it was compassion. Compassion I've never seen, never felt, and don't even comprehend to this day. And that was amazing to me. That I could see that even people that don't even know each other but know what's going on in their lives, that they would have that much compassion for one another, that they would be grieving.
So that intensity of feeling had this huge impact on you. And you came back to the States on leave, and while you were here in the States, you made another life-changing decision.
Yeah. Well, I finally get my 2-week leave, and I guess it was funny. My sergeants, I guess, thought that since I was on pretty rocky terms with my family and going through so much stress and hadn't been sleeping very well, that they were afraid that I was going to not come back. They decided to pull me in the room and kind of have this little E6 line private first class Rivera on why not to desert and say basically they could do anything they want to me, not just ruin my life, but they can also, if they wanted, make an example of me and kill me during a time of war. Personally, that came from their mouths.
They actually threatened that possibility of executing you?
And I'm like, okay. By this time, there was nothing that they could say or do to scare me straight.
But their threats to you, including the possibility of execution, obviously didn't have the intended effect, because you came home and you and your husband talked about it, and together you decided to...
Yeah, my husband, I didn't spare him any details while I was away because I wanted him to be able to efficiently deal with the things that would be going on with me, because I was so much afraid that I was going to change and I wasn't going to be the person I was when I left. And it was very much so the case. But in a way, I was also enlightened. And I may have those times in my life where my emotions are just run rampant in my soul, and I have these moments of real anger, and I just don't understand why. But just being in that environment, I was like, that's what it was. And it was pretty hard for me to handle myself. And the only thing I describe it sometimes is I feel like I'm on this roller coaster that goes out of control and gets off of its tracks and crashes. And in some instances, that's how I feel.
It's like you're living in a bad dream.
Yeah, and I'm in a bad dream and I'm in a bad way. And I couldn't take the steps that I needed to try and understand what it is I wanted to do, other than I've already expressed to him while I was in Iraq. I didn't want to be there anymore. And I told him why. And I got home and I was such a wreck. And I was just thankful that he was able to step up and find information for me and just try and see what it is that he could do to help me. And we just were on the internet one day. I don't know how it happens, but just popped up the War Resisters campaign and several other stories of different GI resistors. And he explained to me that we could go to Canada, and I just kind of, I don't know if I laughed it off or what, but I just kind of disregarded it and said, no, there's not really a way that I could do that, leaving my country. You know, that's a pretty harsh thing to do. That's like rejecting everything you grew up with, everything you've learned, everything you've known of yourself. It's like taking a piece of your identity, flushing it down the toilet, and that's how it felt. But in a way, I was like, I would rather lose some of the pride, and I would rather lose some of the ideology of America than participate in fighting and participating in doing some of the things I thought over there wasn't protecting my family at home.
So you piled everybody in the car and you drove to, where did you cross?
Well, still, we were on the road. We decided to go on the road. Just drive, because we didn't know, or I didn't know exactly if I wanted to leave our country or not. And everything that I knew and everything we've accomplished just being there. For the first time, we were able to buy furniture and be able to live in a new way instead of in a very impoverished situation. And it was really hard, really hard. And we just went on the road instead of going to Colorado. We were going to go the long way to there, to Colorado. I mean, we still hadn't made up our mind exactly to this gigantic decision in our life to actually bolt with it. And we decided that we'd make St. Louis our deciding point, being that we go east or we go west. And we went up the Mississippi River, and we were going to go in this gigantic circle to Fort Carson. And we got through Kansas instead. We didn't stop in St. Louis. We drove all the way through Kansas, stopped in Kansas City. And we spent about 10 days there just talking with each other, trying to see if this is the right way, is this what we need to be doing. And finally, we both agreed, you know, what we're losing isn't quite as much as we think, and it won't be as hard as long as we're together and we have our babies and we're happy. And so we drove back through Kansas and started going east. And the further and further east we got, the less dread feeling that we got. The more west we went, the more sense of dread just came over us, like we knew what we were in for, and it was whatever the military wanted. So we drove up right through Buffalo, and February 18th, we were on the bridge, and we crossed through Canada with our IDs. Of course, Mario's not military, and I'm a female, so you just don't automatically assume that there's a female soldier wanting to evade the military and the military's responsibilities. And so we get through perfectly fine. And it was like the most ugliest day that I have ever seen in my life. But I've never been to New York, so I don't know what an average ugly day is up there. And it was like the darkest day you've ever seen. It was snowing and raining at the same time. And like as soon as we got on the bridge, the birds came out, the prettiest blue sky ever, and a rainbow even. And I'm like, it's got to be the right thing here, you know? It was like the best omen. If I had doubts about coming here, I definitely didn't by the time we crossed the bridge.
And when you got across, did you meet with people from the War Resister Support Campaign, or were you on your own, or how did that work?
Well, we were on the road for about 2 weeks, just in and out of different places, and I was super paranoid, and I don't know if Mario was, but I definitely was. And I've seen and done the drag outs myself, you know, in Kuwait. We did the trainings for taking prisoners and clearing out rooms and houses, so I had some sense of knowing exactly what they did on the raids, even though I've never been out on the raids myself. And so it's pretty scary having that SWAT-type training and knowing that the way that you would probably take someone out is the same way that they would take you out. And so we were hopping around a lot. We weren't staying in one particular place. We didn't use the internet. We didn't get online, we didn't enter cell phones even, we took out the batteries, and we took out the SIM cards. So if they tried to check our phones to see if they were working, they would just know that it wasn't working, instead of just being turned off. That's how strong you felt you were being pursued. And any state you go to, they can find you on your social security, they can track your credit cards, they can track money even, if they wanted to. And so it was pretty frightening. But we got to Canada, and we felt very relieved that we were there, and maybe like I could start my healing process from Iraq and just continue with our lives.
You've applied for refugee status in Canada now?
Yes, I had, and our entire family. And recent news basically tells us that the Supreme Court doesn't want to hear any resister cases.
Now, there's a hearing coming up before the refugee board this week, yes, on Thursday?
Yes.
Are you going to go to that hearing with other resistors?
Yes, I will be. And basically, that's a hearing to all the IRB and political people as to why they should take up U.S. war resisters in Canada.
And are you going to testify at the hearing?
A lot of material is going to be submitted. Like, most every war resistor in Canada or in the Toronto area is going to submit their personal statement. And Chuck, who is an E7, been in the military about, 17 years, and was like 3 years from retiring, decided that he and his wife would come to Canada as well. And so he's going to actually be presenting a lot of evidence, not just his personal, but just highlights of each resistor that's going to be there at the hearings, and then submit the tips to the members.
You should know that there are a lot of people down here doing as much as they can to try to encourage Canadian officials to let you and all the GI resistors in Canada stay in that country. And I also want you to know, Kimberly, that I think you're an amazingly articulate and compassionate woman, and it's been a real privilege for me to have this time to talk with you. And I'm sure everyone who hears this interview will be extremely impressed with the kind of person you are. Thank you so much for talking with Courage to Resist.
Thanks for having me.